Hey, Noteworthians, and welcome to another mini-sode episode of Noteworthy, aka your weekly worthy-sode. Today's episode shall be on none other than Miss Ella Fitzgerald. So get ready, get set, and let's get started, shall we? So I can't lie, the first time that I ever heard of Ella Fitzgerald was actually from an old show called, well, Codename Kids Next Door. Now, it wasn't that she had like some sort of feature on it or anything. It was more of a, they did a skit where one of the kids accidentally knocks down, well, a chimp knocks down a bottle of Salmonella Fitzgerald, and then all you hear is, well, that. And that was my random ever knowing of some sort of what Ella Fitzgerald was back in my younger years. But later on, of course, I wisened up and learned more. So, well, get ready, get set, and I guess here we go. So Ella Jane Fitzgerald was born on April 25th, 1917 in Newport News, Virginia. She was the daughter of William Fitzgerald and Temperance Tempe Henry. Her parents were unmarried but lived together for at least 2.5 years after she was born. In the early 1920s, Fitzgerald's mother and her new partner, a Portuguese immigrant named Joseph da Silva, moved to Yonkers in Westchester County, New York. Her half-sister, Frances da Silva, was born in 1923, and by 1925, Fitzgerald and her family had moved to nearby school streets, a poor Italian area. She began her formal education at the age of 6 and was an outstanding student, moving through a variety of schools before attending Benjamin Franklin Junior High School in 1929. She and her family were Methodists and were active in the Bethany African Methodist Episcopal Church, where she attended a worship service, Bible study, and Sunday school. The church provided Fitzgerald with her earliest experiences in music. Fitzgerald listened to jazz recordings by Louis Armstrong, Bing Crosby, the Boswell sisters. She idolized the Boswell sisters, lead singer Connie Boswell, later saying, "My mother brought home one of her records and I fell in love with it. I tried so hard to sound just like her." In 1932, when Fitzgerald was 15, her mother died from injuries received in a car accident. Her stepfather took care of her until April 1933, when she moved to Harlem to live with her aunt. This seemingly swift change in her circumstances, reinforced by what Fitzgerald biographer Stuart Nicholson described as rumors of ill treatment by her stepfather, leaves him to speculate that da Silva might have abused her. Fitzgerald began skipping school and her grades suffered. She worked as a lookout at a bordello and with a mafia-affiliated number of runners. She never talked publicly about this time in her life, though. When the authorities caught up with her, she was placed in the colored orphan asylum in Riverdale in the Bronx. When the orphanage proved too crowded, though, she was moved to the New York Training School for Girls, a state reformatory school in Hudson, New York. Now, eventually, Ella escaped from the reformatory. The 15-year-old found herself broke and alone during the Great Depression and strove to endure. Never one to complain, Ella later reflected on her most difficult years with an appreciation for how they helped her to mature. She used the memories from these times to help gather emotions for performances and felt she was more grateful for her success because she knew what it was like to struggle in life. Now, while she seems to have survived during 1933 and 1934, in part from singing on the streets of Harlem, Fitzgerald made her most important debut at age 17 on November 21st in 1934 in one of the earliest amateur nights at the Apollo Theater. She had intended to go on stage and dance, but she was intimidated by a local duo called the Edwards Sisters and opted to sing instead at the very last moment while on stage hearing people booing her and asking her, well, what's she doing here? Performing in the style of Connie Boswell, she sang Judy and The Object of My Affection when she was later on asked for an encore, and she won first prize. She won the chance to perform at the Apollo for a week, but seemingly because of her disheveled appearance, the theater never gave her that part of her prize. Off stage and away from people she knew, well, Ella was shy and reserved. She was self-conscious about her appearance and for a while even doubted the extent of her abilities. On stage, however, Ella was surprised to find she had no fear. She felt at home in the spotlight. She said, once up there, I felt the acceptance and love from my audience. I knew I wanted to sing before people the rest of my life. In the band that night was a saxophonist and arranger, Benny Carter. Impressed with her natural talent, he began introducing Ella to people who could help launch her career. In the process, he and Ella became lifelong friends, often working together. Fueled by enthusiastic supporters, Ella began entering and winning every talent show she could find. In January 1935, Ella Fitzgerald won the chance to perform a week with the Tiny Bradshaw Band at the Harlem Opera House. She was introduced to drummer and band leader Chick Webb, who had asked his recently signed singer Charlie Linton to help find him a female singer. And although Webb was reluctant to sign her at first because she was gawky and unkempt, a diamond in the rough, he offered her the opportunity to test with his band, and when they played a dance at Yale University, met with approval by both audiences and her fellow musicians. Fitzgerald was asked to join Webb's orchestra and gained acclaim as part of the group's performances at Harlem's Savoy Ballroom. Fitzgerald recorded several hit songs, including Love and Kisses and If You Can't Sing It, You'll Have to Swing It. But it was her 1938 version of the nursery rhyme, A Tisket, A Tasket, a song she co-wrote that brought her public acclaim. It became a major hit on the radio and was also one of the biggest selling records of the decade. Webb died of spinal tuberculosis on June 16, 1939, and his band was renamed Ella and Her Famous Orchestra, with Fitzgerald taking the role of band leader. She recorded nearly 150 songs with Webb's orchestra between 1935 and 1942. In 1942, Fitzgerald left the band to begin a solo career. While working for Decca Records, she had hits with Bill Kenny and the Ink Spots, Louis Jordan, and Delta Rhythm Boys. Producer Norman Granz became her manager in the mid-1940s after she began singing for jazz at the Philharmonic and concert series begun by Granz. On the touring circuit, it was well known that Ella's manager felt very strongly about civil rights and required equal treatment for his musicians, regardless of their color. Norman refused to accept any type of discrimination at any hotels, restaurants, or concert halls, even when they traveled to the Deep South. Once while in Dallas touring for the Philharmonic, a police squad, irritated by Norman's principles, barged backstage to hassle the performers. They came into Ella's dressing room, where band members Dizzy Gillespie and Illinois were shooting dice, and arrested everyone. "They took us down," Ella later recalled. And then when we got there, they had the nerve to ask for an autograph. Norman wasn't the only one willing to stand up for Ella. She received support from numerous celebrity fans, including a zealous Marilyn Monroe. "I owe Marilyn Monroe a real debt," Ella later said. "It was because of her that I played the Macambo, a very popular nightclub in the 1950s. She personally called the owner of the Macambo and told him she wanted me booked immediately, and if he would do it, she would take a front table every night. She told him, and it was true, due to Marilyn's superstar status, that the press would go wild. The owner said yes, and Marilyn was there, front table, every night. The press went overboard. After that, I never had to play a small jazz club again. She was an unusual woman, a little ahead of her times, and she didn't even know it. Now, with the demise of the swing era and the decline of the great touring big bands, a major change in jazz music occurred. The advent of bebop led to new developments in Fitzgerald's vocal style. Influenced by her work with Dizzy Gillespie's big band, it was in this period that Fitzgerald started including scat singing as a major part of her performance repertoire. While singing with Gillespie, Fitzgerald recalled, "I just tried to do with my voice what I heard the horns and the band doing." In 1945, scat recording of Flying Home, arranged by Vic, would later be described by New York Times as one of the most influential vocal jazz records of the decade. Where other singers, most notably Louis Armstrong, had tried similar improvisations, no one before Miss Fitzgerald employed the technique with such dazzlingly inventiveness. Her bebop recording of Old Lady Be Good was similarly popular and increased her reputation as one of the leading jazz vocalists. Fitzgerald was notoriously shy. Trumpet player Mario, who played behind Fitzgerald in her early years with Chick Webb, remembered that she didn't hang out much. When she got into the band, she was dedicated to her music. She was a lonely girl around New York. She just kept herself to herself for the gig. When later in her career, the Society of Singers named an award after her, Fitzgerald explained, "I don't want to say the wrong thing, which I always do, but I think I do better when I sing." Fitzgerald is sometimes referred to as the quintessential swing singer, and her meetings with Count Basie are highly regarded by critics. Fitzgerald features on one track on Basie's 1957 album, 1 O'Clock Jump, while her 1963 album, Ella and Basil, is remembered as one of her greatest recordings. With the New Testament, Basie band in full swing and arrangements written by a young Quincy Jones, this album proved a respite from the songbook recordings and constant touring that Fitzgerald was engaged in during this period. Possibly Fitzgerald's greatest unrealized collaboration in terms of popular music was a studio or live album with Frank fucking Sinatra. The two appeared on the same stage only periodically over the years, in television specials in 1958 and 59, and again in 1967, and a show that also featured Antonio Carlos. Pianist Paul Smith had said Ella loved working with Frank Sinatra. He gave her his dressing room on A Man and His Music and couldn't do enough for her. When asked, Norman Granz would cite complex contractual reasons for the fact that the two artists never recorded together. Fitzgerald's appearance with Sinatra and Count Basie in June 1974 for a series of concerts at the Caesar Palace in Las Vegas was seen as an important incentive for Sinatra to return from his self-imposed retirement of the early 1970s. The shows were a great success, and September 1975 saw them gross $1 million in 2 weeks on Broadway with the Count Basie Orchestra. Now, $1 million back then is way more than $1 million right now. Just saying, put that in perspective. Fitzgerald had suffered from diabetes for several years of her life, though, which had led to numerous complications. And in 1985, Fitzgerald was hospitalized briefly for respiratory problems. In 1986, for congestive heart failure, and in 1990, for exhaustion. In March 1990, she appeared at the Royal Albert Hall in London, England, with the Count Basie Orchestra for the launch of the Jazz FM, plus a gala dinner at the House Hotel at which she performed. In 1993, she had to have both of her legs amputated below the knee due to the effects of diabetes. her eyesight was affected as well. But in that same year, though, in 1993, Fitzgerald established the Ella Fitzgerald Charitable Foundation, focusing on charitable grants for four major categories: academic opportunities for children, music education, basic care needs for the less fortunate, and medical research involving around diabetes, heart disease, and vision impairment. Her goals were to give back and provide opportunity for those at risk and less fortunate. In addition, she supported several nonprofit organizations like the American Heart Association, City of Hope, and the Retina Foundation. She died in her home from a stroke on June 15, 1996, at the age of 79. A few hours after her death, the Playboy Jazz Festival was launched at the Hollywood Bowl, and in tribute, the marquee read, "Ella, we miss you." Her funeral was private, and she was buried at Inglewood Park Cemetery in Los Angeles. Dubbed the First Lady of Song, Ella Fitzgerald was the most popular female jazz singer in the United States for more than half a century. In her lifetime, she won 13 Grammy Awards and sold over 40 million albums. Received the Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award and an honorary doctorate of music from Harvard. Her voice was flexible, wide-ranging, accurate, and ageless. She could sing sultry ballads, sweet jazz, and imitate every instrument in an orchestra. She worked with all the jazz greats, from Duke Ellington, Count Basie, Nat King Cole, Frank Sinatra, Dizzy Gillespie, and Benny Goodman, or rather, some might say, all the jazz greats had the pleasure of working with Ella. She performed at the top venues all over the world and packed them to the hilt. Her audiences were as diverse as her vocal range. They were rich, they were poor, they were made up of all races, all religions, and all nationalities. In fact, many of them had just one binding factor in common. They all loved her. And that is Miss Ella Jane Fitzgerald. Thank you, Noteworthians, for listening. And before we put out our next full-length episode of Noteworthy, please go back and check out the talented Ashley Young, a.k.a. the Alien. I got that from freaking Christine. But yeah, thank you guys, and goodbye. Noteworthy is brought to you by CC Black Girl Production. Christine, do your thing.
Athena, say bye.